This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
Good morning, and this is The Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector. And today, our conversation is with Michael Cardo. Michael Cardo, most people probably know his name as someone who is a member of Parliament. He's been in Parliament for, oh goodness, well, just on 9 years now. And your portfolio is for the opposition on the importantly contested issues of employment and labor. And you have Michael has a background in history, university studies, including a PhD, University of Cambridge. And before becoming an MP, he was a researcher, speechwriter, policy analyst, the kind of skills, I guess, that allow you to tackle a big topic like his current book, the one that's just out, a biography of Harry Oppenheimer. Probably doesn't need much of an introduction to most people in South Africa. We've been encountering his name for a very long time. But Michael Cardo, before he went into politics per se, worked for the Department of the Premier in Western Cape, and he's been a visiting research fellow. He's got another book, biography of a Liberal Party leader. Liberal Party doesn't exist anymore as a party anymore, but it was influential until effectively it disbanded itself over government regulations about the legality of having an open membership, all race membership. And that book was Opening Men's Eyes, Peter Brown and the Liberal Struggle for South Africa. That's 12, 13 years ago. And in between that book and now, you obviously spent a lot of time writing and researching and thinking about Harry Oppenheimer. How did you end up with Oppenheimer as a subject? Why did you pick him?
Well, I was commissioned to write the book by my friend and publisher, the late, great Jonathan Ball. He approached me one day over one of our regular breakfasts and said, I think you should write this book. And it was a very exciting prospect for me because Harry Oppenheimer is such a towering figure in South African history. He straddles the whole of the 20th century. He was born in 1908. That was 2 years before the Act of Union, when the South African nation was born. Obviously, it was born as a nation founded on segregation and the exclusion of blacks from citizenship. But the point is that he was alive at the birth of the Union, and he was still alive 80 odd years later when the South African nation was reborn as what Archbishop Desmond Tutu evocatively christened the Rainbow Nation. So he was alive long enough to witness the transfer from an authoritarian state based on white supremacy, essentially, to a non-racial democracy. And he was so intimately involved in so many different aspects of South African history. Not only was he a corporate titan, having been the chairman of Anglo-American and De Beers for a period of a quarter of a century, he assumed the chairmanship of both of those companies upon the death of his father, Sir Ernest Oppenheimer, in 1957, and he continued in the role at the helm of Anglo until the end of 1982, and of De Beers until the end of 1984. He stuck around for an extra 2 years at De Beers to see the diamond industry through a particularly trying time. And he really was the totemic figure in the South African business establishment for that period of time. But he was also a philanthropist of note. He was also intimately involved in South African politics. He had been a member of parliament himself for a period of almost 10 years in the 1950s. He was elected to parliament in 1948, where the National Party came to power on the platform of apartheid. He was a member of party, a member of the United Party representing the constituency of Kimberley. He was a great Jan Smuts loyalist. So anyway, it was for all these reasons, given his importance in South African history, given the fact that there was no pre-existing biography of Harry Oppenheimer, there was a dual biography of Harry Oppenheimer and his father, Sir Ernest, published in 1973, called appropriately Oppenheimer and Son, but nobody else had done an in-depth study of this man, and I just thought it would be a great opportunity to get stuck in, especially given the fact that I was going to get unfettered access to all the Oppenheimer papers kept at the Brenthurst Library and the Oppenheimer's family estate.
Does this make, because there's been, as you know, in this country in the last couple of weeks, there's been something of a scuffle over a biography that was more than just authorized, that was well paid for. Your book, do we call it an authorized biography? Do we call it an unauthorized biography? And if it's unauthorized, and if you have access to all of what must be rooms worth of documentation, how do you avoid ending up writing a kind of hagiography of someone that you came to respect, admire, and appreciate in many ways? Tell me a little bit about this process.
So the book is certainly not an unauthorized biography. It carried the authorization of the Oppenheimer family, and I make no bones about that in the acknowledgments of the book. I had the cooperation of the family, and that was absolutely essential because it enabled me to access what you rightly terms as rooms of material at the Brenthurst Library, where not only are Harry Oppenheimer's papers kept, but those of his father, Sir Ernest, his mother, May Oppenheimer, as well as the papers of all the family members and various other records that have come in from Anglo-American, from De Beers, from the family holding company, E. Oppenheimer and Son. And there is a mountain of material that I had to work through there. And I would never have gotten access to it had I not had the authorization and the go-ahead of the Oppenheimer family. So it was essential in that respect for me to access the archival material. But then also fundamentally, it enabled me to speak to a whole range of people who knew Harry Oppenheimer very well. So even though Harry Oppenheimer died in 2000, and he was an elderly man when he died. He was 91 years old. There are still many people alive who worked closely with him at Anglo-American and De Beers. And obviously, it was much easier for me to speak to these people, to speak to the close associates of Oppenheimer, with the doors essentially having been opened. The family gave the go-ahead, and they told people, feel free to speak to Michael Cardo. He's the biographer. He has our permission to undertake this project, and that made it much easier for me. Look, there are pros and cons to authorized biographies versus unauthorized biographies. Unauthorized biographies tend to suffer, I think, from the fact that if there is a treasure trove of material available, as there is in the case of Harry Oppenheimer, if you don't have permission to work through that treasure trove, well, then obviously you're going to be predominantly reliant on secondary sources, on newspaper articles, on magazine articles, on hearsay, on secondhand accounts, on other secondary sources. Whereas with access to primary archival resource material, you're really able to construct history afresh, as it were. And as I reflect in the acknowledgements, the seal of authorization can be a double-edged sword, but I had a number of engagements with the Oppenheimer family, and you know, the words that stick out clearly for me was an early conversation I had with Harry Oppenheimer's grandson, Jonathan Oppenheimer. And he said to me, you know, we're certainly not looking for a hagiography out of this, and it was never my intention to produce one, because I'm a trained historian. Yes, I suppose it's true I share certain ideological inclinations with Harry Oppenheimer, although I'm certainly not uncritical of his brand of liberalism. But I wanted to do justice to the subject, and as an historian, that means not producing a book that is either an outright condemnation, denunciation of your subject, nor, on the other hand, is it about producing a slavishly sycophantic work of historiography. And to the credit of the family, they really gave me absolute free rein in the archives. You know, I mined that quarry and made of it what I wanted to, and they certainly did not seek to impose any changes upon the manuscript, for which I'm very grateful. It was a very privileged position for me to be in.
We're speaking with Michael Cardo, author of his new biography, Harry Oppenheimer. Fascinating book, all 450 pages of it, which I'm working my way through. This is Brooke Spector with The Deep Dive. We'll be back.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, your host, and we're speaking with Michael Cardo, the author of the new biography of Harry Oppenheimer. The book itself weighs in at about 450 pages, which means you used a fair bit of that. Obviously, you didn't copy it all. We'd have to have a truck to move it around. I didn't know him very well. I met him maybe twice. He was when he was chancellor at the University of Cape Town, came up and did a presentation to the alumni circle in what was then the Southern Transvaal. My wife was a UCT graduate, and so we attended the event. After his presentation, which was about the challenges of the university, obviously, he said, "You're going to have to excuse me. I have to go home now." And I'm looking at this man who is clearly in his 80s, and my vision was he's going home. The butler is going to help tuck him into bed, give him the warm milk, the cookies, and the pill that he takes every night. And then he paused and said, "I have to go to Russia tomorrow morning at 7 to talk some sense into those diamond dealers over there." And my vision of him switched, you know, from version A to an entirely different version. Then here was a man who was still active in his chosen field well into his early 80s on what would be a seriously difficult, challenging, tiresome, fully engaged moment. Yes, of course, private plane maybe, and people take care of things for you when you're that well off. But still, it changed my opinion of him rather a lot. When I reflected on your book, as I say, I haven't finished it yet, but I'm working through it studiously. When I think of the Oppenheimer universe, Harry Oppenheimer universe particularly, there are two almost competing places. There's the one building a vast commercial and mining empire. You know better than I do that in the late 70s and early 80s was a behemoth in the Johannesburg Stock Exchange in terms of valuations, and had investments in almost everything, as well as international investments. But so much of that had been built, of course, on the backs of migrant laborers from neighboring countries and within South Africa who were by no means well paid for their work, lived in horrible conditions. And I did visit in previous years some of the mining compounds. And that somehow is at odds in some important ways with his liberal values, with his support for the arts, with his contributions to progressive causes, the Chairman's Fund, scholarships, that whole rest of things. I mean, talk us through how he balanced those two very different worlds.
Well, I can almost date that Russian trip exactly. I think he went to Russia for the first time in 93 or 94, so you're quite right. He would have been well into his 80s by that stage, and he was possessed of remarkable energy, not just physically, but also mentally. You know, he was a man who was deeply engaged with the world. He had an abiding passion for international affairs. He traveled regularly. He and his devoted wife, Bridget, kept to a relentless social schedule, and they socialized with the great and the good of not just South Africa, but people across the globe. So he was certainly a man who kept at it and kept busy and kept engaged right until his death. You know, the story about Harry Oppenheimer told to me by so many people I interviewed was that he continued going into the office at 44 Main Street in Johannesburg long after he retired in the mid-1980s. He would keep on going there almost right up until his death, I think, and he was a sort of an eminence grise. He wielded tremendous soft power, and even deep into the 90s, very few decisions would have been taken by the chairman of Anglo and De Beers without Harry Oppenheimer's involvement or consultation. But the question you ask about his politics is really the central one, because he has a reputation in South Africa of being a liberal, of someone being committed to liberal causes, both politically and philanthropically. But Harry Oppenheimer himself always said he had a number of stock lines which he liked to trot out to journalists. And one of them was, you know, in the South African context, I might seem like a liberal, but really at heart, I'm just an old-fashioned conservative. And he was a liberal of a conservative bent. I think his politics are probably best described as Tory. He was very closely aligned and acquainted with many senior figures in the British Conservative Party establishment. And he straddled various divides. So although he was a Smuts loyalist and a Liberal United Party member of parliament when he was elected in 1948, he was still very much a man of his times. And South African liberals at that time didn't really tend to question the segregationist order or the fact that blacks were excluded from citizenship. They took it to be entirely normal. And I don't think Harry Oppenheimer was an activist, social democratic liberal in the sense that the subject of my first biography, Peter Brown, was, and many of the people involved in the Liberal Party, which was formed in 1953, were. He was essentially quite conservative. And the other thing about him that is noteworthy is that he had deep pockets with many discrete compartments. So at the same time that, for example, he bankrolled the formation of the Progressive Party in 1959, this was the liberal wing of the United Party that broke off in 1959 and was essentially the predecessor party of what is now today the Democratic Alliance. Even at the same time that Harry Oppenheimer was bankrolling the Progs, he still found time to give funds to an organization called the South Africa Foundation, which really, I think, served to launder the apartheid government's reputation abroad. He struck up a friendship many years later with Mangosuthu Buthelezi and was a generous donor to the Inkatha Institute, which was the think tank associated to Buthelezi's outfit Inkatha. He also in the 1980s gave money to Winnie Mandela, who at that stage was exiled to Brandfort. So in some senses, I suppose a detractor and a critic of Oppenheimer might say that he spread his bets and he spread his risk, which is not an uncommon thing for very wealthy businessmen with an interest in politics to do.
We're speaking with Michael Cardo, author of the new biography on Harry Oppenheimer. I'm Brooke Spector with The Deep Dive. We'll be back in just a minute. Hold your thought, Michael, and we'll continue in just a sec.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
I'm Brooke Spector, and we're chatting with Michael Cardo. Chatting, I think, is probably the wrong word. Actually, we're in an interesting discussion about the topic of his new book, which, of course, is a biography of Harry Oppenheimer. You were talking just before the break. You were explaining the businessman with political interests spreading his or her bets. by bankrolling or supporting or contributing to a range of activities. I'm trying to get my mind around a check that goes off to the South Africa Foundation and another check in the same outbox that goes to Winnie Madikizela Mandela on the same afternoon as the mail goes out.
Those would have been many years apart, in fairness.
Okay. I just thought it was a great image.
As I was saying, the legacy that he left is complex, and the core of it really goes to the fact that he presided over a diamond and gold empire for such a long period of time, as did the Oppenheimer dynasty, and dynasty is an important theme in the book. And this was an empire which its detractors, with some legitimacy, claimed profited from the terrible triumvirate of the migrant labor system, from the pass laws, and from the often inhumane and squalid living conditions of migrant laborers who were herded into single-sex compounds. Now, on the plus side of Harry Oppenheimer's ledger is that, unlike the chairman of various other rival mining houses in South Africa, he was comparatively forward-looking and progressive. And certainly by the mid-1970s, he had come to realize that something needed to give, something needed to change. He had always been of the view that apartheid was economically unworkable, that it was impracticable, it just made no economic sense, and that racial discrimination and free enterprise were incompatible. And in the early part of the 1970s, when there was a lot of stuff going on internationally, macroeconomically, he started to undertake various initiatives which ultimately led to an improvement in the living and working conditions of black mine workers working for Anglo and De Beers. And this meant that black wages in the Anglo stable were increased. There were various changes made to the living quarters of Anglo and De Beers mine workers. And a couple of years later, Harry Oppenheimer really was the pioneering crusader among the white business establishment for the recognition of black trade unions. And as we all know, black trade unions came to play an extremely important role politically in South Africa in the transition to non-racial democracy. So as I reflect in the book, he was a product of his times. He was a man of his times. He wasn't necessarily by any stretch of the imagination as forward-looking as some other South African white liberals, but he played a very important role in the transition to non-racial democracy. And this was something that was acknowledged by Nelson Mandela, with whom he struck up a friendship of sorts in the 1990s. Mandela, certainly after Oppenheimer's death, publicly stated that the Oppenheimer family, and Harry Oppenheimer in particular, had played a very important role in bringing together big business and the new ruling party in the mid-1990s to try and make sure that this experiment of the Rainbow Nation got off the ground and worked.
One of the things that I do know about him on a personal level, and you mentioned it in your book at some length, is his love for early 19th century British poets, Byron, Shelley, and built up a collection of those works, as well as what used to be called Africana, which I guess now is called Southern African Historical Materials. Where did this connection, Byron and Shelley don't seem to me to be on the face of it, the obvious connections for a South African businessman?
Quite so. Not an interest, I think, shared by many of his peers at the time in 44 Main Street or in the broader mining community. The passion for Africana was inherited from his father. Sir Ernest Oppenheimer started collecting Africana from a relatively young age, from the time that he was living in Kimberley. Ernest Oppenheimer came out to Kimberley in 1902 as a young man of 21, 22. He arrived 6 months after the death of Cecil John Rhodes, and he lived there until the family was driven out in 1915 during the First World War. Anyway, Ernest Oppenheimer was a collector of Africana, and when eventually the family settled in Johannesburg and Sir Ernest Oppenheimer bought the Brenthurst estate in 1922, he converted the smaller house on the property, Little Brenthurst, into a library. And so much material was collected. Harry, as I say, inherited this love and interest in Africana. And at some stage, there was just too much to be kept in Little Brenthurst. So Harry Oppenheimer built what is now the Brenthurst Library in 1984. It was opened by Alan Payton, and all the Africana materials were moved there. And Brooke, so I'm not sure whether you've actually visited the library, but within the library is Harry Oppenheimer's own private study. So he would often amble down from the main house, followed by one or two of his whippets, and he would go and seek refuge and sanctuary in this private study of his, which is a lovely study. It's ringed with all his first editions of Byron and Shelley and Keats and Shakespeare. And he would just go and sit there and read. I think this interest in English romantic poetry, he probably imbibed during his time at Oxford. He went up to Oxford in 1922. He had been schooled at Charterhouse, which was an English public school, is an English public school. And he'd won a scholarship to Oxford, and he spent four blissful years there, where he liked to say he was extraordinarily lazy. He didn't apply himself too hard to his studies, but it was the one period of his life where I think he was genuinely free. And he obviously spent a lot of time indulging his reading interests. And I think this was the moment where he fell in love with the English romantic poets.
It's somehow I could see all kinds of interests, but Byron and Shelley, yes, from the university days, but to continue it and to keep collecting it and to be publicly known for it when you're busy trying to figure out how you can squash the opposition in the diamond fields, beat down the trade unions digging gold, that's a man of parts who's managed to keep them rather separately compartmentalized.
Quite so. And I think it's worth saying that very few business people, I think, have a similar sort of hinterland, and that hinterland is absolutely vital. Maybe the fact that he was so enamored of the English romantic poets, the fact that he had this outlet, this form of refuge and sanctuary, maybe it enabled him to apply himself all the better in those difficult, taxing moments where he had to push a deal over the line in negotiations with a very difficult person on the other end of the bargaining table. So I think this all goes to illustrate the complexity and the depth of the man. He certainly wasn't the cardboard cutout figure that many of his opponents try and reduce him to. And by that, I'm really referring to the people who speak about Oppenheimer as the kind of sinister embodiment of white monopoly capital, something which is spoken about nowadays, but which has earlier echoes, which we can also speak about when Harry Oppenheimer was reduced to the figure of Hoggenheimer in the 1950s by his National Party opponents.
This is Brooke Spector at The Deep Dive, and we're speaking with Michael Cardo, who has just released a substantial biography of Harry Oppenheimer, and we'll take a commercial message or two, and then we'll be back.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, and we are back speaking with Michael Cardo on his new biography of Harry Oppenheimer. Now, before we took our break, we were discussing his love for romantic English poets and his secret hideaway in his library, even as he was carrying out major multi-million dollar rand pound business deals. I have this vision now of him sitting on a private jet, winging his way to Moscow, looking at Ozymandias, trying to figure out whether or not this applied or not. And if so, for whom? But there's a more interesting or more challenging topic. And you mentioned it just before we took the break, which is the sinister figure of Hagenheimer, which some listeners may recall as a conceit of conversation in this country, and its contemporary echo in a way of the current discussion over white monopoly capital. They're not the same thing, but obviously there are some threads that are similar. Perhaps you could take us through the Hagenheimer story and then your feelings on what it means in terms of the current issue.
Yeah, well, as many of your listeners will know, Hagenheimer was an anti-Semitic trope. Hagenheimer, even though the name sounds very similar to Oppenheimer, doesn't stem from Oppenheimer, either Sir Ernest or Harry. It actually traces back to the English musical tradition where Hagenheimer was this kind of grotesque, Semitic-looking figure who personified rapacious, greedy, British Jewish mining finance capital. And in South Africa, in the early 1930s, at the time of the gold standard crisis, Sir Ernest Oppenheimer was depicted in the Afrikaner nationalist press by a cartoonist called Bunzaya, who was the cartoonist for Die Burger. Sir Ernest Oppenheimer was depicted as Hagenheimer, and Hagenheimer actually is a significant trope in Afrikaner nationalist discourse in the 1930s and 1940s, and then it begins to wane, but it was certainly revived in the early 1950s, by which time Harry Oppenheimer was in Parliament, and he was regarded as a great and sinister threat to Afrikaner dom and to the traditional Afrikaner values of solidarity, piety, and integrity. There was a great fear, and it was actually an anti-capitalist fear. Many of those Afrikaner National Party members of parliament and ministers, cabinet ministers, had socialist sympathies, and they wanted to nationalize the Oppenheimer's mines. There is a clear echo and resonance with the advocates of white monopoly capital today. So I think when Harry Oppenheimer started getting very involved in the United Party, he was almost seen as an heir to Jan Hofmeyr, who had been the finance minister and Smuts's deputy. Harry Oppenheimer was doing all sorts of important policy work. He was raising funds through an outfit called the United South Africa Trust Fund, which was bringing money into the United Party. And all of this made the nationalists very, very nervous and anxious indeed, because bear in mind, their majority, their win in 1948, had been very narrow, and there was no guarantee that they were going to triumph at the 1953 election. In fact, many in the United Party thought this was going to be a short-lived victory for the Nats and that the tables would be turned at the 1953 election. All of which is to say, a lot of pressure and odium was placed on the figure of Oppenheimer by the National Party intelligentsia in the 1950s, and he was reduced to this figure of Hagenheimer. And really, Hagenheimer is revived at various points in the 50s and 1960s. And my point in the book is that both the people who speak about white monopoly capital and Hagenheimer, which is associated with another concept called die Geldmacht, money power, literally, is that both of the kind of people who employ these terms are essentially working out of a nationalist demonology, which is anti-capitalist and at times strongly anti-Semitic.
I want to get to questions of legacy, because, you know, there's the old trope, which I think you mentioned, that any family concern, any corporation set up by a founding father, it runs four generations before it disappears almost entirely from family connections. The founder, then the builder, and then the spender, and then the vanisher, I guess, if you will. And as I understand it now, there really is no direct material connection between Harry Oppenheimer's descendants and the company that he led for so many years and that his father effectively had established. Although obviously there's wealth in place in other forms. And in fact, Anglo-American, although we often like to think of it as a gold mining company in South Africa, as far as I understand it, doesn't actually mine gold in this country anymore at all. Assets in gold mining are in many other countries, but no longer in South Africa. I'm not sure about the diamond mining, but I think there's still some diamond mining that's directly part of the De Beers legacy. But talk a bit about the legacy of Harry Oppenheimer in business and commercial terms, as well as social and political terms.
Well, you're quite right. You know, the line of thinking, which I suppose one can trace back to the famous story of Buddenbrooks by Thomas Mann, is that there's a progressive loss of financial aptitude, acumen, and entrepreneurial vigor as you go down the generations. So the first generation builds the empire, the second generation consolidated, but by the time you get to the third and fourth generation, they're spending the money or frittering it away, and eventually the house comes crashing down. That's not what happened in the case of the Oppenheimers, although they are no longer involved in Anglo and De Beers. So what happened at the turn of the century, 1999, 2000, is that the third generation made a decision, and by the third generation, I mean Harry Oppenheimer's son, Nicky Oppenheimer, made a decision to exit mostly from Anglo and concentrate the interests in De Beers, rather, in the diamonds. And De Beers was privatized in 2000, and the Oppenheimer family sold a great deal of their stake in Anglo American in order to finance a 40% share in De Beers. The other shareholders were Anglo American, which held 45%, and the remaining 15% was held by the Botswana government through a vehicle called Debswana. And fast forward 11 years, Nicky Oppenheimer decided to exit entirely from De Beers, and he sold the family's stake in the diamond empire for a pretty penny, for a hefty sum of money. So he certainly did well in translating that wealth, which had been built up over a very long period of time, into cash. So Nicky Oppenheimer certainly didn't lose the family's money. On the contrary, he turned it into hard cash, but it's true that the family is no longer involved in Anglo and De Beers. And I think there are a couple of points to be made about that. Harry Oppenheimer himself was always very aware that keeping Anglo and De Beers as a family enterprise was going to become much, much harder as the years wore on. You know, by the 1980s, certainly Anglo was a vast mining and industrial conglomerate that had separate operating divisions, all of which were run by professional managers. So to maintain family control over that was going to become increasingly difficult. And Harry Oppenheimer was very aware of that. But in his own case, in Harry Oppenheimer's case, what he did as the second generation heir to the empire was really to build on and consolidate and expand what he had inherited from his father, Sir Ernest, in 1957. So when Sir Ernest Oppenheimer formed the Anglo-American Corporation in 1917, he essentially conceived of it as a sub-Saharan African enterprise with interests in diamonds, gold, and copper. He died in 1957. Harry became chairman, and very quickly he begins, does Harry Oppenheimer, to diversify Anglo-American into secondary industry. And this is really a process signaled by the formation of Highveld Steel, which is a gigantic steel producer formed in 1964. And soon, by the late 1960s, Anglo-American has got interests in not only steel and iron and vanadium, but also in property, in construction. It constructs the Carlton Center in downtown Johannesburg. It runs the second biggest construction company after Marion Roberts. And it also has enormous financial interests. It becomes a significant shareholder in Standard Bank. It starts the first merchant bank in South Africa, a bank called Union Acceptances, which is eventually sold. And it also goes into partnership with the Schlesinger Empire, which gives it a range of interests in insurance companies, to the extent that by the time Harry Oppenheimer stands down from Anglo at the end of 1982, the corporation accounts, I think, for something in the region of between 60 and 70% of the JSE's market capitalization. So it completely dominates the South African economy. And that is one aspect of Harry Oppenheimer's legacy, the fact that he really takes Anglo-American into secondary industry so that it's no longer simply a traditional mining finance house. On the other hand, he is much more of an internationalist than his father. As I said of Ernest Oppenheimer, he really conceived of Anglo as a sub-Saharan African enterprise, whereas Harry Oppenheimer, given his cosmopolitan interests, inclinations, and aptitudes, wants to establish Anglo and De Beers as a global empire. And he takes Anglo into North America in a big way in the 1960s, helped by his great friend, a remarkable figure, a colorful man called Charles Engelhard, who becomes a great friend of Oppenheimer's. He was supposedly the inspiration for the character of Goldfinger in the James Bond novels. And he's really this larger-than-life man who lives life on a lavish scale, flying across the world in his private plane called the Platinum Plover. He made a lot of his money through platinum, did Charles Engelhard. So Anglo goes to North America in the 1960s. It becomes, by 1981, the single largest investor in the United States economy through Anglo's international affiliate company, which is called Minorco. Anglo also extends to Australia in the 1960s, and eventually it has a foothold, a significant foothold, in almost all of the continents. It also has a company called Charter Consolidate, which I write about in the book, which is based in London, which is a significant player on the scene in Europe. So that's the other aspect of Harry Oppenheimer's corporate legacy. The fact is that he built Anglo-American and De Beers into an international empire. And in this way, he built on, but also expanded the legacy that he was left by his father, Sir Ernest.
We're speaking with Michael Cardo, author of his new biography, Harry Oppenheimer. Fascinating book, all 450 pages of it, which I'm working my way through. This is Brooke Spector with The Deep Dive. We'll be back in just a minute, and we'll wrap up when we return.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, your host, and we're speaking with Michael Cardo, the author of the new biography of Harry Oppenheimer. And just before the break, we were talking about the legacy of Harry Oppenheimer in commercial terms and industrial terms. We have about a minute or two left, but perhaps, Michael, if you could just very quickly, the other legacies, the larger intellectual or cultural legacies that still live on from this individual?
Well, culturally, Anglo-American also had a lot of press interests, and I think the Anglo-American group kept the liberal flame alive in the English language press for many years, although not without controversy, principally when they closed down the Rand Daily Mail in 1985. But Harry Oppenheimer was a great believer in liberalism, in the open society, You remarked upon the fact that you met him when he was the Chancellor of the University of Cape Town. That's a role he formed over a period of almost 30 years. He became Chancellor in 1967 and stood down in 1996. And so he played such an important and seminal role in the intellectual life of the country, but he also left a massive philanthropic legacy. There were so many beneficiaries of scholarships and bursaries put out by the Anglo-American and De Beers Chairman's Fund. But beyond that, he also left a legacy as a business statesman. As I reflect in the book, he met the great and the good of many nations, including John F. Kennedy and his wife, Jackie Kennedy. He dined at the White House with them. He had an audience with French President Charles de Gaulle in the 1960s. And there are some wonderful anecdotes which are told in the book about his encounters with these figures.
I think you're going to have to do an audiobook version of it. You're going to have to read this.
It's taking a long time to produce that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, get started now. I put that microphone in front of you. You have a good voice for it. So it's nice and clear and crisp. And I think people will want to pick up on that. If you can find a sponsor for such a project, I recommend it. We've been speaking with Michael Cardo, been delving into, but by no means totally and comprehensively, his new biography of Harry Oppenheimer. And I'm working my way through it, and I expect to finish it this week. This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, as we do every week. Friday morning, we bring you conversation with an interesting and illuminating, informative person in business, in the arts, in politics, in literature, in economics. And we'll be back again next week with another visitor, another conversation on The Deep Dive.